Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back. This is episode 2 of Huey Off the Record. And quite honestly, I'm really blown away by the reaction to the pod so far. And I'm loving doing it, and I'm excited to see where this goes. If you enjoyed the first episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the pod so you never miss a beat. And tell your friends, spread the word. The more listeners, subscribers, and 5-star reviews we get, the better everything goes. So spread love. It's the Brooklyn way. I've got a very special guest on the pod today, but before we get into that, I have some cool information I have to share with you. I'm doing a merch giveaway for the whole of the month of May when you sign up to my mailing list at the website, HueyMorgan.com. No catch, no BS. Just sign up for my mailing list, totally free, and we send you relevant news and updates, first shot on tickets to any live shows I might have coming up, that kind of thing. And everyone who signs up during May will automatically get entered into a prize draw for one of 5 merch bundles, including an exclusive Huey Off the Record t-shirt, an exclusive hashtag the people's champ hat. Nobody has one of those yet. They're not for sale. You know what I'm saying? The winners will be the only peeps to have them. You'll also get a signed copy of my book, Huey Morgan's Rebel Heroes. Spectacular book, if I may say so myself. And a signed print of yours truly to hang on your wall and gaze at. So sign up and tell your friends. Go to HueyMorgan.com and get into the prize draw for some cool, exclusive Huey merch. Sarait, sarait. Okay, so let's get into it. Like I said, a very special guest on today's pod. Changing gears a little bit from my first episode with Ricky, switching it up to connect with my man, Tim Latham. I've known Tim for over 20 years, and quite frankly, he is the best set of ears in the music business. And you get a lot of people telling you that. A lot of Grammys to his name, too. He's a Grammy Award-winning sound engineer and producer who's worked with us, the Fun Loving Criminals, on all our records, as well as pretty much every other awesome record you've ever heard, from De La to Tribe, and a few off-the-wall numbers, and he talks about his varied resume as well. We're brothers. I love this guy. I love his family. We've had to slow down a little bit to make sure you could understand us on this one because we get to talking about the old days in the studio when it just gets a little off the chain. We talk about what's going on in the music business today and some crazy wild stories and connections that we both have. The type of shit you get when you have a combined 50 years of the music business. That's crazy. So kick back, pour yourself something nice, unless you're driving, in which case, pull over first. And tune into a very New York conversation between two old school music dudes. I'm in my man cave in the UK for this one, and Tim is in his man cave / studio in Long Island in New York. It reminded me, I was talking to Becky earlier, and I was like, you know, I remember meeting Tim Latham. I thought I was going to get arrested. Do you remember that story I told you that one?
Oh, yeah, man.
Yes, you were in Mike Schnapp's office.
Yeah.
And he was like, yeah, come up to the office. I think we kind of knew you were coming, but I don't know if that was, like, the exact moment. But I walked in this office, and you were there. I was like, oh, man, it caught up with me.
Dude, you know, funny, I've never told you guys this, but the God's honest truth. As I'm walking towards the building, I walk past you and fast. He was both outside, like, smoking a cigarette, right? I had no idea who you were, and I'm just like, look at these fucking hoodlums. And I walk past you, and I sit down, and I'm just like, oh, shit.
These fucking guys, I gotta be in a studio with these fuck Bob Power.
It's hysterical, though, dude, because I'm like, I'm walking by, like, fucking hoodlums as I walk right past you, you know? It's like, yeah, hoodlums.
Hoodlums in the black. Yo, I tell you, man, that was a funny time, though. That was, I mean, for me, it was my first time in the music business, obviously, but it was really weird because when I got into it, it was like still
the razzle dazzle, man. They were just, you know, the EMI was
for real.
It was for real razzle dazzle. You know, they were backing it up with checks, man. I thought that was wild.
Food accounts, budget.
Yeah, oh my god, yeah, that was incredible. Like Schnapp, we went from like starving musicians to having pot bellies by the time we finished that first record, man.
And that was only like 6 days.
Yeah, I know, that's crazy too, man. You know, but it's really bugged out. When I first met you, when we started working together, I think we clicked for a lot of reasons, but I think we clicked because we weren't trying to complicate shit, you know?
Exactly, dude. All things being considered, I was fairly young for my, for where I was in my career. And you guys were literally the first ones that handed me the keys without hesitation. They said, no, man, you do what you do. We're going to do what we do. And I'm just like, fuck it, yeah, man. This is how you fucking make records, bro.
It was really great for us. I mean, I remember I talked to Fast about this because we did the 20th anniversary of that last year.
Dude.
And crazy, right? We're talking about the Fun Loving Criminals first record, Confine Yourself, for you guys. I know sometimes we talk fast, but we're trying to get around the points. But the thing was, we went in the studio as producers on a major label for a record that we just, we didn't really know what we were doing to the large extent. But Tim, who had been working as an engineer for a long time, we kind of went in there together. And we recorded it in like 5 or 6 days, most of it.
Yeah, 90% of it was done. We started on a Tuesday, and Sunday we walked out of there. On Monday, you guys had taken off. So I think Fast was still working at Limelight on Sunday night, so he had to leave the studio and he had to work all night. So we figured we'll take Mondays off and work Tuesday through Sunday.
Yeah.
So I got on the horn up to the EMI. I'm like, oh, you're done. I'm like, what do you mean you're done? He's like, we're done. We got like another 20 minutes worth of work to do. You're done.
You thought you were quitting. They're like, what do you mean these guys are being pricks to you? What's going on?
I was like, we're done. It was awesome.
So I mean, I know that like before we started hanging out, because I remember we were talking because we had all that time, because the label, after we finished that first week, they were like, you can't be finished. You have another 28 days or something in the studio or whatever, 21 days. And we spent a lot of time hanging out and talking and stuff. And, I think that's why we ended up being friends for so long, because we actually gave a fuck about each other's experiences and shit. And
exactly.
I remember you were telling me some amazing shit, because you were working at Battery Studios, right? When you first, tell me about your school, because you went to bass school, right?
No, I went to Berklee College of Music in Boston.
Oh, man. What's the nickname for that place?
Oh, Jesus. I used to call it like Berklee School of Guitar for Little Boys. Because I heard 2,500 students, like fucking 900 of them were guitar players, and like two of them can play. Wow. It's different now, but when I'm back in the day, I mean, that was like, whatever it was, like almost 30 years ago, it was like that. But now it's like, it's much better now, so.
Yeah, it's weird, man, because you played bass there, right?
Yeah, I went there originally as, as a bass, like as a performance major.
Wow.
And then, my old man called me, who would never pick up the phone to call anybody. And it's like my roommate's like, yo, your father's on the phone. I'm just like, oh, I'm like, who? So I get on the phone. I'm like, who died? It's like, nobody did. Just do me one. Answer me this question. I'm like, shoot, Pop. He goes, where do you fill out an application to be a rock star? I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? He's like, where do you fill out an application to be a bass player? I'm like, Dad, I'm like, Pop, what the fuck are you talking about? He goes, like, do me a favor, just major in something where you can at least apply for a job. I'm like, how about engineering? He goes, whatever the fuck that is, if you're going to apply for a job, just do that then. I'm like, all right, cool. And he hung up the phone.
Man. Well, Inspector Latham was a formidable dude, man. I mean, was that someone, when you were growing up, was it like, because I think in a lot of ways, like, your work ethic kind of comes through where your parents were working. I mean, with me, it was. My mom was just like, just trying to always, do better than she did the day before, right? And
hell yeah.
I remember you told me that great story about your dad when he was a rookie, but I'm not going to get into that if you don't want to tell that story.
Oh, gee, he's passed, but I don't think the statute of limitations has run out yet, and I'm still probably like an accessory after the fact.
We don't want to get him in trouble with St. Peter, man.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But no, what I'm saying is, like, he was a serious guy, right? I guess when you're an engineer, he was like, yeah, that sounds like it might work on somebody's application, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then, like, one day he came into the studio, and after, like, 10 minutes, he goes, how the hell you sit here listening to the same goddamn thing all day long? I don't hear a shit of difference of what you're doing. It's like, well, that's why I do what I do. And he's like, all right, whatever this is, thanks.
Well, I keep telling Bo the story. My boy keeps wondering about sugar stories, and every time he goes to bed, I tell him sugar story. So I told him the time he tried to dig to China. So Sugar's at the Latham Pet Farm, and we're out on tour, and I come back, and I'm talking to your dad in the backyard, your dad and your sister, right? And and I'm like, wait, what are you building over in the backyard here? Because this is a big 6-foot hole, man. And your dad's like, I'm not building anything here. That's your dog did that. I was like, oh. And then your sister starts laughing. I'm like, whoa, I'm sorry. I didn't know. She's like, look. It made her happy, so we let her do it. And like he was like, when the Chinamen were coming through the hole, I would have bopped him on the head with a bat. But you know,
or like a service revolver.
Yeah, exactly, a throwaway piece, man.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, I wanted to talk about like when we first started hanging out. We were always pulling your coat about all the hip hop bands you worked with in the studio. Because Battery was like the place where all these dudes would roll through, right? Was it Jive's studio or something?
Yeah, Battery was under Zomba.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Tribe and them, right?
Yeah, but Zomba was like, yeah, so Zomba Publishing to start with, and also owned, it was Jive Records. So it was Zomba Publishing, Jive Records, so it was, you know, it was Boogie Down Productions, it was Tribe in the very beginning, and actually Billy Ocean was kind of the one who put the whole thing on the map for us.
So. Really?
Yeah.
Billy Ocean's a cool dude. I met him, man. He's cool.
He's mad cool.
Oh, yeah, he's mad cool. Yeah, serious cool guy, man.
Yeah, but actually, I mean, Battery, the first one was actually out in Willesden, actually. I did a couple of records out there once, a couple of times out in, Northwest London, I guess.
Yeah, I used to live up that way, NW2 or something, right?
Yeah. So they started there. They came over to the States, and the guy, the other Clive, I called Clive Calder, who was, like, just completely on the down low, just, like, built, like, this, like, literal empire. And so Battery was one of the studios, like, was, like, kind of, like, became, like, the studio.
But, dude, were they washing bad money? I heard they were washing bad money because, dude, all of a sudden was buying everybody's publishing from them.
Dude had, well, let's put it this way. He had everybody's publishing.
Yeah, he had bought it, though, with some kind of money. That's what I'm saying.
I don't know how we, like, what's the word they use? Fungible? Fungible. But I know, I mean, he's South African, and I'm pretty sure, I mean, with, you know, no disrespect or anything like that, I'm pretty sure he was like a diamond miner as well.
In the conflict diamonds and shit.
Yeah, exactly. You don't know, bro. It was kind of shady, but yeah, so, but he started the whole thing, and it was, like I said, it's like, so he built Battery Studios in New York, and it quickly became like the spot for like hip-hop records, man.
And it was when Jive, they had Tribe on it, because you worked on a couple Tribe records. That's how we actually got put on you, was Bob Power.
Yep, Uncle Bob.
How'd you meet Uncle Bob?
I was at Battery, you know, and he was coming through, and it was like the way he kind of, like, landed kind of, like, in the driver's seat was he was working for a production studio. He was, like, a composer. And a lot of times, like, the engineers just wouldn't show up, so he was, like, by default became, like, his own engineer.
Okay.
Yeah, it was this place called Calliope.
I remember Calliope, yeah.
You know what building it was in.
Yeah, yeah, crazy, man.
It was the top floor penthouse of a place that became like Minor Music or something like that.
Yeah, it was our old manager's spot, that scumbag. He ended up fucking suing us.
Yeah, so that was Calliope Studios, actually, and that's where Bob came from. So he would come into Battery every once in a while, and, you know, he's not shy about this either, but, you know, he would come in and he would, you know, he has amazing ears, but, like, some of the technical stuff, he didn't really, you know, have it, you know, he didn't have it on lock, so.
Yeah.
He would just have me do, like, more of all the technical stuff for him, and we just, like the same thing, like, with, like, you and I and Fast, like, we just formed, like, this bond where me and Bob were just, like, working on records, like literally, like, the second time that I met him.
Wow, that's cool, though. Because he was a righteous dude. We had, see, the story of how we got to you is a little bit weird, too. Like, we had signed this deal with EMI, and we had worked out this 8-record deal with them, and we were trying to figure out how we were going to actually start recording the record. And we had made a little bit of a demo tape at Steve-O's house, because he had that studio with his brother. And, you know, it ended up being what the record was, but we had this kind of demo tape, right? And EMI was like anybody in the world, because David Segerson was a record producer for like the Bangles and shit like that. He was the CEO and president. He's the dude that gave us our deal, because Uncle Mike Schnapp brought us up that. So it was kind of weird, because he was like, who do you want to produce your record? And, like, we kind of were banging a lot of Tribe Called Quest back then, man. We, like, loved, because we knew we were a live band, but we, like, we want that low end, man. We want that tight boom bap, you know, because it kind of...
One head's to nod, bro. You
got to have it, right? So we looked at who produced that record. It was Bob Power. So we said, Bob Power. And they were like, okay, give us your demo tape. We'll send it over to Bob's and see what he says. So he took a meeting with us. We're sitting around a table with David Segerson, you know, pretty much all the people on the board at EMI America. And Bob goes, you know, first I'd like to say, and this is how cool Bob is. He goes, first thing I'd like to say is these guys don't need a producer. They just need a great engineer. And he looks over at us. He goes, his name's Tim Latham. I'll give you his number. And and like this is in front of like a whole board of EMI, right? And we were like, damn, but we really want you to come to the studio with us, you know? He's like, don't worry. Tim Latham, he'll know what to do. And by the way, how'd you get the guitar sound on that one track? And we were like, what? And that's how we got put onto you, bro.
And I was sitting out. I was actually in L.A. when I got the call from Schnapp working with the Far Side.
Oh, dude.
Yeah, dude. Like, everything was, like, kind of winding down out there. And I got the call from Schnapp. It's like, I'll be on a plane tomorrow morning. I never heard of these. Whatever, you know. He reached out to me trying to explain the whole thing to me. He's like, yo, man, I'll be at JFK tomorrow morning, man. So it was like a day or two later, I passed you hoodlums in the street without you knowing it. Walked upstairs and you know, whatever it is, like 23 years later, we're still friends.
Yeah, for real, man. And, you know, I think we've worked together on every record we put out, man. So
it's every one.
Every damn one. And the thing is, like, you are the fourth criminal, you know. And it's kind of always been that way. And they always... We always kind of throw that term around because when you're in a studio with somebody, it's like, you know, especially when it's just four of us, right? It's not like maybe there was the assistant engineer, but that dude was just
exactly.
He was pretty much rolling joints and syncing the tape machines up and stuff.
Yep.
But, I mean, you're more of a hands-on engineer than a lot of people give you credit for, I think. Because, I mean, you were going into patch bays and doing all this other shit. Like, you had your skills down, you know what I'm saying? You had the knowledge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, most, like, the assistants were just, you know... With the exception of course, Juan over at Steve Rosenthal's Magic Sound.
Yeah, absolutely.
Basically slowing me down. So just get the, you know, get out of my way.
You're slowing me down, kid. You're slowing me down.
If you're not three steps ahead of me, you're behind me. So
but, I mean...
That was, like, my upbringing was like that with my pop. So it's just, like, that's how we got... That's how that whole work ethic carried through.
Yeah, because I'm, like, going in there, and just because I remember we went in there, it was, like, at the Magic Shop on Crosby Street, which is not there anymore, yep. Unfortunately. But
sadly.
Arguably the best tracking studio in the world.
Yeah, it was my favorite place on the planet.
Yeah,
Steve was like, he's my favorite, one of my favorite people in the industry, if not the.
Yeah, he was so awesome, man. He still is awesome. I mean, the studio wasn't there, but he's still there.
He's still a man.
But yeah, but that was in, like, I remember doing that first record, man, and, like, weird kind of things, like, you know, Ben's Pizza. I think of Ben's Pizza, the big board, which is where we kept all the songs and all the different parts of all the songs so we knew what we had.
The big whiteboard.
Yeah, the big whiteboard. And doing vocal tracks and opening up the vocal booth and looking through the whole studio and seeing the cobblestones out on Crosby Street. Because they had that one, that right from that vocal booth on the left, you could just look all the way down. It's fucking great, man.
I love that. I mean, it really was magic. But it was like making a record in your house is what it felt like. It was just so comfortable.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was really the perfect spot for us to go in and, you know, for you guys to get comfortable in a room and stuff like that. I mean, your first record and stuff. And it just... Obviously, I mean, it's plain as day that it worked out for everybody.
Yeah, it's crazy that we went in there. And, like, we went in there, was the first day we did drums because we built the tent, right? No, the first day was sequences. So we dropped
sequences. Yeah, we laid down, like, all, like, the sequence tracks.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the method that we came up with then was, like, Steve-O did his thing.
Yeah.
And then it was just, like, you know, you and 50 would go in and do, you know, the bass and guitar, something, like, a lot of times together. And when I try to explain to anybody who, you know, who's a fan of the record, and there are many, many of them, like, I tell them, I was like, look, 99% of that record is the first take.
Yeah, that's the crazy shit. I mean, because if people think about, like, Steely Dan going in the studio or Pink Floyd, even with those
guys. 9 days on a. Am I like to curse as much as I typically
do? You can curse all the fuck you want, man.
Yeah, like, going in there for 9 fucking days to try to get a hi-hat sound, it's just like, gee, no, get no fucking way, man. I couldn't do that.
It just seems like it was, I mean, it's also maybe a different age, but us going in there, we were motivated to get it down quickly because we thought at any moment, because, you know, we are who we are, we thought at any moment the record label would just admit their mistake and like take us out of the studio.
Yeah, pull the rug. I mean, I've seen it happen too many times. I'll just like pull the rug out from people.
Yeah, and like, you know, then we had kind of talked about it, like, you know, this is some different shit, and you were like, yo, I like it because it's different shit, but yeah, you're right, this is some different shit. So we were like, yo, let's get it down before, you know, someone from uptown comes down and just pulls the plug on it. So that initially was why I think, but I don't think we consciously were like, yo, let's cut corners. I think that was the thing. We found it so easy working with you because anything we had like an idea about, you'd like, here are eight options around that idea. And that was like amazing for someone to actually be that on side. You know what I mean? Like, you kind of were in our heads as well. We all kind of like laid it out.
Yeah, I mean, because it was, I won't say it was easy, but it was, I mean, a lot easier because you guys are just like some of the most awesome human beings to hang around with. Some of the most awesome human beings to make music with, and I was a fan of the music, so I'm just like, wow, man, this is, you know, it was like a dream for me, you know, it was like, you know, I still, like, look back on those days, too, and it's just like, I'm just so grateful for that, like, that first meeting with you guys, and, like, everything for the past, you know, it's like 20-something, 23 years, yeah, you know, man. Since then, I'm just totally, totally grateful for
it. Likewise, man, I did a lot of looking back last year, because it was 20th anniversary and stuff, and I was like, man, we got so lucky that we hung out with all the great people. I mean, because it's like 20-something years later, right, and I'm still hanging out with you, I'm still hanging out with Mike Schnapp, I'm still hanging out with Fast, you know, it's like, a lot of times that shit just don't work, man. I mean, a couple of people fell off, but nothing major. You know?
No, it's amazing. Yeah, and I try to like, I try to play games with myself. I'm like, ah, wow, that was 20 years ago, man. I'm fucking 50 years old now, right? That's like 20 years. I'm like 20 years. All right, so that was like the White album to like the first Whitesnake album.
Yeah,
and you know, like 20 years. You know what I mean? Or I was like Benny Goodman to like the first Ramones record. I'm like, fuck, man, that's a long time.
Or as we say a lot of times, from the fucking Motorola to the iPhone, man. Remember the fucking Motorola?
Unfortunately, yeah.
Well, dude, I mean, when I think about the times we used to hang out and order food from Little Charlie's, man, and shoot the shit, you had like great stories. I remember you had worked with the Wu-Tang Clan, and everybody was like, "What are the Wu-Tang Clan like?" You're like, "Yeah, they're all right."
Yeah, no, there's some stories that we just keep on, you know, we keep close to the vest with that. But
yeah, no, I hear you. No, but was working with Wu-Tang,
Tribe, yeah. De La. Let's put it like,
yeah, the De La guys, to this day, I see Mace. We played some place with them over the summer, and I saw Mace, and Becky saw Mace, and we were like, oh, what's up? And he's like, yo, what's happening, fam? Have you spoken to Tim Latham? And we're like, Latham! And he's like, and then Posse comes over, here's your name. He's like, Latham? And it's just amazing that, like, you know, a dude, like, I mean, I got to say, like, you've spanned all the different, you know, genres of recording, right? I mean, you won.
Yeah, it's pretty funny, man.
But you just won a Grammy recently, last year, to add to another Grammy that you had before that. So it's not your first Grammy, it's the second, right? And you got this one for recording the soundtrack to the Hamilton musical, right?
For mixing it.
For mixing the Hamilton. I mean, dude, that is crazed, bro.
Yeah, I mean, it's like literally, you know, you look at my CV and it's, no joke, it's Britney Spears, The Old Dirty Bastard. Rewind, with no joking around, Elmo from Sesame Street.
Yeah, you did Elmo's record.
Did some shit with Elmo and Will I Am from the Black Eyed Peas, who also did the Black Eyed Peas. And then I got Lou Reed up in there. Uh-huh. And I got these fucking hoodlums from New York City, the Fun Loving Criminals. And now I got like Broadway cast albums of it. And so it's.
Yeah, you went from hip hop to show tunes. But I mean, but Hamilton, it's like, I'm talking to you from my house in England right now. And I'll tell you, Hamilton's coming over to London, to the West End, pretty soon, I think, right?
Yeah, yeah. Again, it's like I formed a relationship with that whole sort of universe of people around Lin-Manuel Miranda, the composer.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend Alex Lackamore, who's the Lin's orchestrator and arranger, and he's now the musical director. He was a conductor for the show. So now he's kind of going all over the place and setting up all different companies. So he was just in London like a couple of weeks ago, setting up the band for it. He was setting the whole thing up.
Yeah, to get the band. I mean, they're good hitters out here, man. They got good musicians out here. It's England, man. It's not Belarus or nothing. But I mean, it would be interesting to see. I mean, because the show. I mean, if people haven't heard of that show is pretty much like one of the biggest Broadway shows in the history of Broadway shows. Am I right?
It literally is, yeah. I mean, and it's like with no exaggeration, it's just like I had heard about it in 2012.
Yeah.
Alex Lacamoire and I were working on a record together, and he's just like, yo, he's like, you're not going to believe Glenn's next project. He's like, it's going to change everything. I'm like, wow. I mean, that's kind of a bold statement, but I trust you, you know, emphatically. I'm like, what is it? He goes, it's Hamilton. And I'm like, what? George Hamilton? What? The fucking guy.
George Hamilton.
Like, no, you idiot.
The tan dude? The tan guy?
That's what I call, bro. Hamilton, that's the first thing that comes to my mind.
No, you're not changing everything with that, bro.
Right? So I was like, no. Alexander Hamilton. I'm like, oh, homeboy, they got shot by Aaron Burr. He's like, yeah.
Homeboy.
Yeah, and then he's like, but it's a period piece. It's all done in period costume. I was like, oh, that's cool. And he's like, all the actors are black and brown. I was like, oh, that's cool. And then he said, and it's hip-hop. And that was my reaction. I was like, I don't mean disrespect or anything like that, but it sounds like a punchline, bro. And he kind of got it. Like, he knew, like, we knew each other really well by that point, so he knew I wasn't being disrespectful. Mm-hmm. But a hip-hop musical in period costume with black and Latino actors about one of the founding fathers, who would have known? Like I said, it just sounds like a punchline. Who would have known that it was actually the turn into the phenomenon that it actually is?
I'll tell you, that motherfucker Lynn got some vision, bro.
He is, you know, people like throw that word, the word genius around too loosely.
Yeah, they do. But this dude, he might be one, bro.
He literally is. I mean, yeah, you when you're sitting around him, you just can't believe it. Like, when I was, like, we were mixing the record, like, we had to mix it out of sequence because we had to do all the heavy lifting first because we had, a ridiculously tight deadline. There wasn't, like, 24 hours of room on either side of it. We just had to finish it.
Wow.
So I'd be listening to it, and it's so complex, and the writing is just so incredible. And then I'm thinking, it's like, wow, he wrote everything. He wrote all the music. He wrote all the lyrics for all the actors, for all these, like, and I would stop the playback, and I would just look at him like, how the fuck did you write this? I was like, this is just insane. And he would kind of like, you know, he'd get like all shy. I'm like, no, really. Like, how did you write this?
And is he like a boy wonder, or is he like one of those crazy dudes that just got like too much mind?
No, he is like one of the nicest, most genuinely warm, gentle souls that you will ever meet. He is a wonderful, wonderful human being.
Well, this was not his first Broadway play though, right?
No, that where I met them was on his first play, which was called In the Heights, which is about life in, you know, up in the Northern Territories of Manhattan.
I think the Northern Territories, Inwood.
Up on like 240. It's like, what the hell, you know, you only go up there if you're, you know, if you're going up there for a reason. You're not going to
If you're going up there for a reason, you don't wander.
You wander through Central Park on the way to the east side or the west side. You're going downtown or whatever. You don't wander through Washington Heights, you know? So, I met them on the cast album for that. And that's where I met that whole crew. And it's the same thing. It's like I've known those guys for 10 years now. We've done like a lot of projects in between together, too. So,
well, I remember you started working with those cats, Yerba Buena.
Yeah, and that's funny enough, man. It's like Andres Levine from Yerba Buena, who actually sang on Loco by the Fun Level Criminals.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, so he was kind of like the sort of like producing their first record, and like, well, they need an engineer. Like, well, it's like a Latin record, but it's hip hop. And he's like, well, I know this guy I do a bunch of Latin records with, and he's also done a shitload of hip hop. How about Tim Latham? Like, who the fuck is he? And so, you know, checked out my CV, and it was a perfect fit. You know, because I did a bunch of, you know, guys like Brazilian, Colombian, Argentina, Peruvian records with Andres.
Yeah.
You know, the Tribe, De La, Barside, The Roots, all that stuff.
You definitely had that shit down. But the one thing
then it came down to the same thing. So then when it came to Hamilton, it's like, all right, so now I'm really familiar with the Broadway cast album genre. Mm-hmm. But I also got my hip-hop bona fides down still. So, again, it's just like, all right, Latham's the guy.
Latham got the bona fides, man.
Bone fades.
Bone fades. We talked one time. We were hanging out at maybe like a Tangiers Blues Band thing, right? And I think you were working with the dude from Giant Step, the flute playing dude.
Yeah, man.
What was
Richard Wurst?
Yeah, man. And you were, I remember you telling me something, you were working on this Latin record and there were 90 something tracks. And I was like, what the, how the, and then you was like, but dude, it's Pro Tools. And this is like on the advent of like that stuff going wide.
Yeah.
And like,
that was the beginning.
Yeah, that was the beginning, right? I mean, how did that change like what you do? Because I mean, obviously, you know, there's just more stuff for your ear to kind of like make sense out of, right?
Yeah, it kind of, it's, you know, I'm sort of agnostic towards it.
Yeah.
Like some people hated it and some people loved it. I was just kind of like, it's a tool. And I you know, I come from the school that, you know, it's not the tool, it's the fool.
Yeah. No, I mean, for people who don't know, Pro Tools is a computer program that allows pretty much anybody with a laptop and, what, $500 to have...
$500, and now you're a record producer, rock star, video producer. Yeah, so now...
It proliferated
the
studio.
About $1.5 million, $2 million worth of equipment and squeezed it into a laptop.
Yeah, and that changed the whole shit up, man. All the studios almost went out of business.
Most of them did.
Yeah, well, that's why Magic Shop, right?
Magic Shop held on to the very end. You know, all the big ones closed. I mean, Avatar is still open.
Yeah, that was the Power Station, right?
Power Station, yeah. Where we cut some 100% clubbing. We cut.
Yeah,
up there.
That's that 20th anniversary is coming up next year. You know what me and Fast are thinking of doing? We're gonna do another mimosa. We're gonna call it.
Oh my God!
We recorded a couple songs out here at the farm, like some demos and shit. Think we're gonna go back in a couple weeks, knock a couple out. I got a really good cover song that no one's ever heard before. Well, they might have heard it, but they don't know it because it's kind of recent, but it's badass. And yeah, I think we're gonna probably go and do that. So we'll be giving you a call for the studio anyway with that. But
yeah, and this is where it also ties in. Now, this is why I think, you know, some people kind of like really were against Pro Tools and stuff like that. But I saw the handwriting on the wall like 2004, 2005 at a rare moment of foresight. You know, it's happened like twice in my life. The first time was marrying my wife.
Yeah, word. Me too.
You know, right? I was just like, yeah, I'll tell you about that.
Them girls saved us, man.
Yeah, exactly. And then I saw the handwriting was on the wall. It's like studios are going to start closing because the budgets kept shrinking and shrinking because labels were just basically buying new artists. Here's Pro Tools, go make your record. Without any consideration, like I said, it's the tool. It's the fool, not the tool. So you're giving like these tools to people who don't know how to use them properly. I mean, you can use them. You can figure out how to, like, you know, whatever, press spacebar and record something. But without
That's all it takes.
Pretty much, yeah. But it's also now it's allowed. It's given me access to stuff that which wouldn't have been possible because of like time and expense, but it's also given people access to me who wouldn't necessarily have the time or expenses to be able to do a record with me in the studio. And so just so the listeners know, so it's also cool now, like with you and me, when we did your solo record, we were just sending files back and forth between each other without ever. We were at the beginning, but like towards the end, we were never even in the same room together.
Yeah, and that's when I came to New York and we recorded some stuff with King and things, you brought your laptop through, man. It was like, that's the thing where I always kind of like it is, you know, it's always the, you know, it's always the bad dancer that complains about the music, right?
You better believe it, bro.
You know what I'm saying? So if you're going in there and you're like, yo, I'm going to try to get some stuff, I think you're just getting, I mean, someone like you is going to get it. I mean, but I even think it proliferated a lot of stuff that you hear now that wouldn't have got to a big studio that ended up being huge because no one would have put money behind it because it was like a grand a day to get in the studio. Yeah. Then you got to start paying engineers. Then you got to start paying whoever, you know.
Food, rental, it was roughly $3,000 a day.
Yeah.
To make a record. You know, a decent record was like $3,000 a day, roughly.
So I remember because when we first did our record deal, there was like literally, you know, it was like almost $100,000 to record it. It cost, you know, with everything in. I remember it was the biggest bank loan I think I ever took out, man.
Yeah, but at the biggest, what, 185% VIG though?
Oh, yeah, but we ended up doing okay. We still,
I know.
We went all right with that. But it was kind of weird because, you know, I talk to a lot of young musicians now, right? And you know, a lot of them, you know, they kind of say, like, you in New York, or you hustle, what the fuck should I do? You know, how do I get my thing going? And you know what? I don't really have a straight answer for them. I only say, you got to make sure your shit sounds as good as you think it needs to sound.
Yeah.
Right? And get it out there somehow. I mean, that's the thing now. You can, if you know, like for me, example, if people send me some stuff on their social media or whatever, I might listen to it, you know, and if I listen to it and it's great, I'm definitely going to play it. You know, and there are a lot of people like me in the world who do radio shows and know people who publish music and things. So I think the hustle's a little bit different because you're not going to sell any records. Like Rihanna was like number one over here for a minute and got knocked out by Drake or something, but he only sold like 3,000 units the week. You know, it's like, or no, and it's like, I don't know if that's the actual number. I might be a little bit low, but it just seemed to me like it was a low number because I remember
the numbers are low, bro. The numbers are real, they're crazy though.
But it, because no one buying shit anymore, man. And it's weird because
you can't compete with free.
Yeah, you can't compete with free, bro.
You can't. How do you compete with free? You know, like, you know.
Oh, that's the truth, bro.
And even with the streaming services now, it's just like, all right, you get like 50 billion streams, and the artist is going to get like a check for like $11.18.
You want to hear something weird with the streams on the UK charts? If like 10 streams is considered a buy.
Yeah, there's a formula here too that kind of figured out the whole thing too. It's just like. There's like tracks with people, I guess it's like a purchase and like a stream, like where somebody actually goes on like YouTube or one of the streaming services and like Spotify or something like that. So whatever, I think it's like every 5,000 streams equals one sale.
Wow, it's that much, damn.
It's something crazy like that, yeah.
Man, because I remember when we charted, we were moving like, you know, tens of thousands of records a week. It was like boom, 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 boom. And it was like, it almost put me off. I was like, I'm selling that many records? Who's making all these records? And it kind of boggled my mind because I was, you know, I low expectations, you know, but I was definitely surprised by the volume that the record company was making, right? Because I knew the numbers behind everything. When they're telling me they're moving 10,000 here, I'm like, wow. You know, that's in a week or whatever. So it seems like I don't think a lot of times the budgets are there because the record company doesn't have that much of a split. I mean, they got to sign someone who already has a million Twitter followers and already has a club hit to a 360 deal. And who's going to do that, man?
Well, that's just it. I mean, sometimes it doesn't even pay. If like if there's like a, you know, an upstart artist, which I'm starting to find now, like I'm getting stuff from people that... 3 or 4 years ago, I was getting stuff that it was borderline depressing, like how mediocre and bad it was, basically. And it just seems to be like this whole flood of like new guys, like younger people, like artists who kind of get it, you know. There's no illusion of like, oh, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to sell like, you know, 3 million records, I'm going to go platinum, I'm going to be flying, you know, first class and all that stuff. They just kind of get like the whole social media thing and how to work their records, where they don't even need a label anymore.
Yeah.
You know? So if they have enough of a following, you know, between Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, where they can go out and they can, you know, make 10 grand in a couple of weeks,
you know,
as opposed to like being indebted with a 360 deal to a major label, which, I mean, for some people it has its advantages. For like bigger artists, it has its advantages. But for somebody coming out of the box, it's just like you will wind up losing money signing to a major.
Yeah, so. It's kind of the opposite. You always think that big record deal from that big record label would be the lottery, right? But it's actually not even a lottery ticket, man.
Nah, man, it's like you're up at first, you know, you're kind of like it's like the bottom of the ninth inning and you're up at, you know, you got like two strikes against you and you're facing like the best pitcher on the major leagues and you got like one swing at the bat to kind of hit it. So.
Yeah, it's nutty now and there's so much weird stuff going on. With a lot of the artists, because I have this, I don't know, maybe it's a philosophy rather than a theory, but you know, like, I mean, let's go back, you know, 70 years, right? So it's like, you know, it's before World War II, recorded music is actually starting to happen. There's like that little bit of music happening where it was really parochial because there was smaller FM, AM stations, right? So they were only going like maybe a state or a couple in a state, not really that big. If that, exactly. So it was really parochial, and if you had a song that was on a radio thing, be it, you know, a blues song or a jazz song or a Oh Brother Where Art Thou kind of bullshit song, whatever it was, you could make up, you could hustle around and do your little thing, and it was better than working a real job, right?
Exactly.
And then, you know, when I first got out of the Marines and I was like, yo, man, I don't want to work a real job anymore, right? I said, I'm going to be a fucking musician. That was my shit. I was like, I was working at the nightclub. That's how I met Fast. But I was working hard, you know, at the club, but I didn't want to work hard forever. And I kind of, like, I enjoyed music, but I also knew that there was a hustle that involved, right? And I was like, I can totally do the hustle. It beats working a regular job, right? Now, that kind of mentality where you don't expect to blow big. I didn't know that our record was going to sell millions of copies when it first came out. But I was prepared to just be that dude that would hustle around and just make it happen. And then everything kind of got really big and all this kind of weird cult of personality happened. And motherfuckers like Kardashians are famous for whatever the hell they're famous for. And they ruined Bruce Jenner. And anyway, no, man, Bruce Jenner, he was my dude, man. I remember that
Wheaties box. What, man? Those Wheaties, bro. Come on.
Yeah, man. Yo, and I, you know, the thing is, I don't need to know that much about anybody. Like, I know.
I don't want
to
know that shit about myself.
For real, man. Like, I don't really. I like Bruce Jenner, but I didn't need to know that he was crazy pussy whipped by his entire family and they broke him. I don't need to know that, but I know that, and that's what's fucked up with the world today. My point being is that I think people's idea of what success is has changed, right? So if you're going to be a successful musician, it's not playing Madison Square Garden anymore, because that's bullshit. It's about actually doing your shit on your own terms.
Exactly.
So I think it's kind of gone back to that. Almost the circle is complete, but there's no money involved anymore either. So that's the thing. It's like it's not the millions and millions and millions of bucks. It's the maybe $100,000 if you play your cards right. But that's better than working for a living, man.
It's better than working for a living. And if you, like I said, if you do it right, though, I mean, you can – like I said, a lot of these younger bands now that I'm coming – that are crossing my bow and stuff, like I said, they kind of get it. You know, they know how to budget themselves and they know, you know – you know, on Twitter, it's just like the thing I retweet myself most about is like, my pro tip of life is just hire pros.
Yeah, well, you know that. But the thing is, like in an age where everybody thinks that they're an expert on anything that they turn their Google to.
Exactly.
You know, I think I had that lyric. What was it? We esteem too easy and obtain too cheaply. And, like, I'm not – it just seemed to me like that really caught a lot of what was going on. Like, instead of actually being, like, the person going, you know, I don't know this, so I'm going to get someone who does. It's kind of transcended where we have, like, a lot of things going on in the world today where we would rather take someone's opinion who is not quite – versed at the subject what we're talking about. And I think that's a lot of that social media shit. And, like, I think it's a good thing ultimately, but it shows us all what the worst of humanity can be. And I think on Twitter you see a lot of that shit. You also see the best, but you see that a lot of times you see the worst of humanity, like people being crazy petty and angry and bitter. And it's like, you know, that's just the way the world is, I think. And I kind of think before all that stuff, we all knew that there were dumb people in the world, Tim, right?
Hell yeah. I mean, come on. They just
didn't have them. Yeah. Well, the thing is, we didn't have to hear from them all the time. Now you got to hear from them all the time, man.
I think the way I look at it, there's just, like, no mystery anymore.
Yeah.
There's, like, no, like, not in the sexual sense, but there's no, like, romance. Like, I remember growing up, man, saving my money and going to the Sam Goody on Main Street in Flushing. Yo, and I'm going to go buy, like, Led Zeppelin 2. I had no idea what those guys even looked like.
Yeah, or where they were from. You know, it's like that's...
Yeah.
Unless you maybe got a magazine and had them in there by chance, you know?
Exactly. If you had enough money, whatever there was, the rock magazines back then, it's like you bought a magazine or you buy the record. It's like, I mean, I don't have enough money to buy the record, so I bought the record. Mm-hmm. You're listening to it as a kid, and it's like, man, you had to imagine, like, what they looked like. You didn't know what they had for breakfast that morning. You want you to know that they just bought a new pair of kicks and they're going to the movies tonight and, you know, pictures of their fucking dinner. Look, I mean, flan. Oh, look at the pictures.
I mean, flan.
Like, who gives a fuck? Like, what, you know, I don't give a fuck about what you mean for breakfast, bro.
Here's me and Justin Bieber making flan.
Exactly. Like, who gives a fuck, man?
Stay tuned and stay classy. There's even more dope stuff coming your way.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's Amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Because I think the younger generation of kids, man, like these, they give these millennials, they be fucking with these millennials a lot, right? You hear them all talking.
It's not their fault.
Not their fault, but also we got to keep in mind, there are a lot of millennials that are doing shit and taking shit in their own hands, man. And we don't hear about that because we're kind of focused on either the, I think it's kind of like the extraordinary or the infamous. That's all you hear about anybody nowadays. Unless someone's really great at something or really fucking horrible, that's all you hear. All us middlemen, and I always consider myself a middleman because I'm like, I'm conservative in some ways and liberal in most other ways. You know, it's like I'm from New York.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm the same way, man.
And it feels like when I watch, you know, media being like television, like, you know, broadcast television, I always feel like I have to like really kind of like remember that they're not selling this to me. It's like they're selling it to somebody else who's really kind of not up to date, you know?
It's like I was raised by like the fucking original Bad Lieutenant, New York City Police Lieutenant. And basically what that means is you don't get away with shit. You cannot get away with anything. I mean, there's no possible way as like a teenager you were getting away with anything. So you kind of grow up around that sort of environment where you yourself begin to smell bullshit better than anybody else around you.
Yeah.
And I watch and like the same thing. You turn on the news, I'm just like, oh man, it's like, don't bullshit me, bro.
Yeah,
but stop lying. I'm not buying it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I think a lot of it is, you know, I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine who I was in the Marines with, right? And we were talking we got together off the Facebook, and I'm calling him up.
Uh-huh.
And he said something I thought was really hilarious, man. He lives out on the West Coast, right? And he was like, yeah, you know, I was driving somewhere, and there was this demonstration going on for like these young people that didn't like Donald Trump, right? And he's like, yeah, so like, you know, I'm just trying to get out of there because I'm trying to get home, right? And he sees this dude pulls up next to him and like motions for him to roll his window down. So he rolls his window down. And he goes, "What's up?" He's like, "Hey man, I saw your bumper sticker that you're a Marine. I'm a Marine too. Yo, we can get out this way. Follow me." And he made a left and went in through a parking lot, like a parking garage. It came out the other side. And the dude pulled up, and the guy pulled next to him. He's like, "Thanks, man." He goes, "Yeah, man, you know, I know we just wanted to get the fuck out of there, and I knew that you didn't know the hood." And it was like a young kid. He was probably in his early 20s. And he'd probably just gotten back or whatever, like off his fucking first hitch. And was just like, yo, I know that a lot of this stuff that people protest and all that stuff, but I'm a millennial too. And it's like, I actually went and actually did something with my life. And I thought that was kind of important to realize that it's not just all these kids complaining. Most of them are actually in the middle doing, you know?
Yeah, because like you said before, it's like the extremes get all the attention.
Yeah, yeah. So you see these kids bugging out, looking really stupid, not really knowing what they're talking about. And then you see, you know, people doing extraordinarily cool things. And it's all the people in the middle that are actually doing the work.
Yeah, and it's like, I don't blame the millennials. I blame their parents.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a dad now, right? And I make a point of letting my son know that you don't get a trophy for showing up.
Hell no. Nobody got it, yeah.
That's not how life works. I mean,
life doesn't work that way.
You could suspend reality for a minute, but you know, if you just
get out of college,
if you displace reality,
it's like, coming at you like a fucking freight train. It's not slowing down for anybody.
But am I doing?
It certainly doesn't give a shit about anybody either. It's going to go right over you and keep going because life doesn't care, man.
You know, word, man. And the thing is, I mean, look at you know, your dad was like, didn't displace reality for you because he knew what good is it going to fucking do you when you actually come out there and you get knocked in the head. At least you know it kind of is what it is early on, and you prepared for it.
Yeah, exactly. You said you know you're going to get knocked on the head. It's going to happen to everybody. Yeah. You know it's coming.
And
you
I
don't
think
know when, but you know that it's coming. So you got to, you know, you kind of steel your heart a little bit, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, my boy's 5 and a half, so it's like he's my boy. I'm not messing with too hard. But he knows what's up. I mean, he travels the subway. I he was chilling with Uncle King over the summer in the subway, right? He got his thing together, man. But yeah, I mean, it was one of those things where I figured the music would kind of like, if you were going to be like a popular musician, it would be brought back to that kind of like parochial gig, you know?
Yeah.
Where like you're big in a certain area for a certain amount of time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, with social media though, I mean, you can see like certain, you can see them, like I said, it's like these guys, they kind of figured the whole thing out, you know? They know how to not use it in a bad way, but how to like use it like properly and sort of promote themselves and get in a van and do like an East Coast tour, and they can set it all up themselves. They don't need a tour manager. They don't need somebody else. Or everybody with their hands out. They can just do it themselves, and they do, and they go out and they make pretty decent living.
Yeah, it's kind of cool in a way because did you see that book that I wrote a couple years back called Rebel Heroes? It was about
of course
it was about rebellion in music, right? And how people sometimes were not being musicians to be famous, but because they were compelled to express themselves, and music was the only way they could do that without their head blowing up.
Yeah, and blowing out.
And I think that's definitely coming back with the younger generation because, you know, as much as us older musicians like to think no one really pays attention to the stuff that happened before them, we all do, you know? And I think these young kids have so much information at their fingertips that they're just, they definitely keep the good and throw away the chaff, you know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Even more, maybe the man's more savage than we were with it, but it took us longer to get to the stuff, so maybe it was nostalgic by the time we got to that Carry On My Wayward Son record by Kansas, but they don't. Yeah, I know, right? But nowadays, people are like, nah, I'll go with that main riff. But I think the kids can digest things quicker, like their inputs are more jazzed up, you know? They're firewire, man.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, because it's all instantaneous. It's right in front of them. It's all there for them to, you know, either absorb or not absorb. But it also could be overwhelming.
But do you think? I think the instincts are generally better. Like they're not filled with any self doubt that I can see. It's like if they're going to do something, they just go and do it musically. That is, you know.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's like that's what I'm noticing with the past couple of years. I've definitely seen a lot more of that, you know. But also from a technical end, kind of like where. You know, where I live in the music industry, I'm getting stuff in, particularly stuff that's been recorded like with acoustic instruments. It's clearly recorded by guys and gals who never had like any sort of mentor.
Yeah.
Like they just think they're the shit because they just did it. I'm like, no, you're not the shit. That's it. This is shit. You know?
I mean, yeah, I mean, like, I see stuff on, like, Instagram where these, like, these Chinese kids in China, literally, like, 8-year-old little girls with the, like, you know, that are shredding, like, Yngwie Malmsteen, making Yngwie Malmsteen look like he's standing still. But that doesn't make you, it's like the technicalities of it. It's like, in music, it's not about being, like, it's not like being a fighter pilot, you know what I'm saying? It's art. It's not about being the Top Gun, you know what I mean? So you can play all that shit, and then you have B.B. King playing one note in the span of, like, you know, 4 bars, and it's the best damn note because it's got all that
feel. And you know it's B.B. King from 100 more, you know, 100 yards away. You know it's B.B. King.
But
but for me, it's like it's more like the technical stuff. It's just like, okay, I bought this microphone, and I bought these microphones, and I bought my Pro Tools. But I don't really – nobody ever showed me exactly how to use it and where, like, you know, where the landmines are and how to avoid them. It's like they read in the magazine that this guy used this microphone on a drum, but not really ever, like, bothering to tune the drum or to move the microphone in a really specific location. So I get, like, these tracks in and, like, you know, boasting of, like, how great they are. And I open them – you know, so I get the file sent to me, and I open them up, and I'm just like, you know, clearly – like, nobody taught them, or nobody ever told them that they suck. At some point in life, somebody said, like, yo, Yo, you suck, bro.
You suck. Go you back. Need to go we get can. Better. But yeah,
go get better.
You know, I always think that, you know, people who are like a little bit entitled to have an opinion tend to be entitled in a lot of other ways in their life.
Exactly.
And yep. That's just but I think people have always been like that, dude. But
it's just like you said though, because everything's at our fingertips now. It's like it's just human nature, man. It's just like there's nothing new about it.
Yo, you used to have a saying. It was quality control. Where's the quality control?
Yeah, where is it? Like, every once in a while, like I'll watch like a movie or something like that, like I don't know. Waterworld. They spent $130 million on this fucking thing. How many fucking times was there an opportunity just to say no,
or just to say, can someone else have a look at this? Because I'm a little so forest through the trees thing, right? With this,
exactly. Just somebody could have said no, you know. Just,
man, but
just before, no, no.
But then there was Ishtar. I watched that recently when Warren Beatty fucked up at the Oscars.
Yep.
And like he didn't really fuck up. He was just like, I don't know what's up. He had doubts, man. He was like, am I fucked up? Did I just have a stroke?
Yeah, he was like, kind of like looking like a deer in the headlights there.
Yeah, but yo, if that happened to me, I'd be like, did I smoke too much weed today? Oh, my God. I'm going to let Faye Dunaway read this shit out. She's straight, you know?
No, but he looked like, man, he was just like huffing paint.
Yeah, I know, bro. He's like, I shouldn't be up here. I'm an old man. I need to go back home.
Like, I mean, dude's like 82 years old, man. I fell for him, you know?
Oh, man, it's crazy, bro. But anyway, so like, you know, I think when it comes around, like with the quality control, man, we used to wonder where it was, and it's. I think sometimes if it always seems like everybody's so savvy now that, you know, if someone's gonna invent a new style of music, like when trap music came out, right?
Yep.
That was one of the things that just did not have any quality control on purpose.
Exactly.
It was like almost like we're going to.
By design.
In spite of your quality control.
Exactly. Which is cool for like, for exactly that.
Yeah.
But if somebody's going to send me like, you know, it's like, oh man, we're doing like this roots rock kind of thing. And we're going for like an edgy sound. And I try to explain to people like, look, man, there is a fucking canyon in between edgy and rough and shit. You know, nobody would ever like listen to like Back in Black and say, wow, man, that's a really pristine recording. It's like, no, man, that's edgy and raw and punchy and shit. Mm-hmm. And like, I get these tracks. I'm like, yeah, it's a real edgy. I was like, no, man, it's just fucking bad.
It's badly recorded, man. Nowadays, with all that, like, if someone sends you some fucked up shit, right? But there's like, I guess a lot of times, like, because you're a song kind of guy, and so am I. I'm like a song guy. And like,
it's all about the song.
Yeah. If the song's in there, is there a way you can, like, unfuck it?
Absolutely.
Is that's where your genius comes in, right? Does that have to do with...
Yeah, I mean, that's my job, really, is how I look at it as a mixer, is to present the song to the listener in the most easily translatable and digestible way. Like, you should be able to listen to that song and understand exactly what the artist was trying to convey.
Does that come back? Because we used to think, like I used to think when I started producing records, right? There was like the main three, which is like drums, bass, vocals. And then the other stuff, kind of like guitar, piano, that kind of sits melody style. But when you mix stuff out, is that like the kind of, because we work together and I kind of think I know, but you do a lot of really interesting techniques when you mix stuff.
Yeah, it's, for me, the lyric is the guide for everything, every decision that I make on the sound of a record.
That's interesting because, it's funny because, if you talk to my boy Fast, it's like, I'll listen to the lyrics.
I love it, bro. No, but I mean, and I'll ask an artist too, if it's not immediately apparent, I'm like, yeah, you know, it could be interpreted like certain ways. I'm like, is this like a first person sort of narrative? Is this third person? Are you telling somebody like, you know, I love you? Or like, how are you telling them? Or like, where are you? Where is this song being told? So, you know, I'll get that from them. It's like, oh, it's like, no, it's not really first person. It's kind of like third person. And that will immediately inform me, like, how to place things in the mix and what sort of effects on certain instruments and where to place them, like, further, like, dimension-wise, like, further back in the mix so it sounds further away, or the vocals could sound a little bit further away, based completely in on the lyric.
Yeah, I remember when we were working together, I think it was... We Were All Very Worried About You, remember that song?
Yep.
Was that on Loco?
That was Electric Lady.
Yeah, Electric Lady. I remember we were mixing that thing, and you were like, "Yo, that's brave, dude." I was like, "What are you talking about, man?" And I know you listened to the lyrics. I think you were talking about the lyric. I was like, "What are you talking about?"
Yeah.
You're like, "That's brave that you'd actually talk about yourself like that on a record." And
yeah.
I didn't realize up until that point that that song was about me.
Yeah.
That's the fucking crazy shit. It's like sometimes as a I'm not saying an artist, but a songwriter, you just write a song because it's like a feeling you have, right? You don't really know the perspective or, you know, the personage and all that kind of stuff until it's almost to the point where you're being mixed. And that's kind of like that's the translation, because I think in a lot of ways, you being a musician and also an engineer and also a regular guy, you know, that makes the perfect kind of translator. Because you could talk to people and you could talk to musicians and you'd be like, look, I think I could be I think you're the bridge sometimes between, you know, that stuff. Because everything I hear you mix, it's like it's accessible to people who aren't experts in that field. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's how I look at my job. It's like literally to make sure that lyric, that song is just presented in a way where it's just immediate to people. Like you shouldn't be guessing as to like what it is.
Yeah, or where the vocal is or where the beat is and stuff. I mean, like when you try to, it's kind of weird, but like when you kind of mix on different speakers and things, that's how I noticed when we first worked together, you had that little auto tone speaker and. Do you stuff where you like listen to on a phone or anything like that to see how those things come out?
Dude, I'm looking at it right now. I have my Iowa boombox that I bought on Park Row at J&R Music World.
I love J&R.
1997.
Yeah,
J&R. Literally, dude, it's like a couple of years ago, we got hit and destroyed by a Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah, I know.
And
yeah, she took my records out
in my studio. And this thing was underwater.
Fuck.
It's a cassette player and a CD player and an AM/FM radio. I plugged it in like maybe 10 months after we cleaned up, you know, got the house, putting the house and the studio back together, and the thing still worked.
It smelled like a grilled cheese sandwich, but it still worked.
Yeah, a little worse than that, but so I'll burn a CD and I'll drop it in there to check mixes on.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, if there's something that's going to, like, be wrong, it's really apparent the second you put it on, like, a real shitty system. It's like, wow, man, that fucking vocal is way too loud. Or like, wow, man, I must, you know, that fucking hi-hat is just way too soft, you know?
Yeah.
So
I remember this. I'm sorry.
It's like a gut check, you know? It's like, yeah, listen. I'll listen to this stuff on my phone.
Yeah.
Like, the little on my phone? Yeah, hell yeah.
I guess, I mean, that's kind of the idea. It has to sound great on, like, a pair of Focal speakers, and it's got to sound great on your iPhone, you know?
Exactly. Yep.
That's a fine line to walk. I mean, I remember that story you told me about, what was that band? The dude, his people only had one speaker, because you kept...
Oh, it was Mobb Deep.
Mobb Deep, yeah.
Yeah,
so Mobb Deep.
Like, the volume would just be so loud in the room, like, while we were mixing and stuff like that. I'm just like, guys, man, I need a career in front of me. I'm doing like permanent damage to my
at
a cellular level on my body. It's like, if you need me, I'm right outside the door. Just like, just wave or whatever. You don't have to come and get me. I'm right here for you guys. They're like, all right, cool, man, cool. That's cool. Time to go. So I'd leave the room, and you know, there'd be like the horns would be kind of panned to the right, and you know, like the other horn sample would be kind of panned to the left. And I come back in, and I listen, and everything is like right up the middle. Pan, like, I thought, I was like, so finally I've had to ask. I'm like, you know, like, Havoc, how come every time I come in here, everything has moved up to the middle? And he said, and it was kind of hard to argue with him. He's like, yo, man, like, you know, some of my people back in the hood, man, their stereos and shit is just like broken. So they'd only be getting half my shit.
They only have one speaker, man.
Oh. You know, speakers, they'll only be getting half my shit. So I was like, I can't argue with you. So. But I, you know, I did say afterwards, though, it's like, well, you know, if they can't afford to fix their other speaker, how are they going to afford to buy your record, bro?
That's true.
Like, all right, I gotta get it, bro. All right. So
and it's kind of weird, but you know, there used to be that thing where people weren't that savvy. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, now every day everybody knows. Like, it's weird because the casual person would know what we're talking about. We're talking about panning horns left and right. Everybody kind of knows. Yeah, it's a stereo thing.
And I think I sort of like auto-tune broke the mold for all that too, because like once you know,
Auto-tune.
It was kind of like inside baseball for like engineers and producers and stuff like that and musicians. The auto-tune was like, oh, that was like total inside baseball. But nobody knew what it was. And then it just became a thing.
Yo, Cher, right? Didn't Cher do it? Cher did, yeah, man. Yeah. Do you believe in love after love?
Exactly, dude. And it was... So once like technology kind of became almost like the... It was kind of like... I don't know. It was like a bandmate almost.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you listen, like people who do it in hip hop, it's obviously Kanye West. Like, it's like what he does when he wants to do his singing vocal. You know.
Yeah. Exactly.
So it's almost like people would
open the door to like people understand the technology.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose you're right, man. And also, it's kind of weird because even things like GarageBand gives you that kind of idea where it has like a fairly easy user interface vibe. So it's like, you know. All that I think all the Apple kind of stuff has made everybody a lot easier with technology, especially our generation. Like my kid knows exactly what to do with the iPhone and iPad. It's instinctual for him, man. But for us, we had to see this shit created. That's different.
Yeah, and people talk about multi tracks. Oh man, I got like my 16 track recorder, and it's just like trying to explain that to somebody even like 15 years ago would have been impossible, but now everybody has it.
Dude, remember when we were doing the first record, we had two two-inch tape machines synced together, man.
Yeah. No, we did that 100% Columbian. I don't think we went to Pro Tools until, I want to say Loco.
Yeah, I think some of Loco was done on that, but we were at Quad, and that's when Joe Strummer was there.
And dude, I will never forget that day as long as I live. You guys are in the live room. I'm sitting in the control room, and every once in a while, you just know when there's somebody behind you and standing there because you just feel them. Like you didn't hear anybody in there. You just like just know there's somebody behind you. So I'm kind of like, I put my head over my shoulder, and Joe Senior's like sitting right behind me. He's like, oh man, I don't really mean to barge in, but Huey said he'd be up here. I'm just like, dude, you're Joe Strummer. You can do whatever the fuck you want, bro. I was just like, holy shit. I'm just like, I can't believe I'm sitting here with you. I was like, the one and only time, dude, I got like starstruck. That's like my jaw just hit the floor, man. I'm like, oh my God, it's Joe Senior, man.
Yeah, Joe Senior was the dude, man. I met him, and he came. Uncle Mike was watching our dressing room at this festival in Scotland, man. Tea in the Park, and we were changing out of our suits into our like sweatpants or whatever. And Joe Strummer just walked in the dressing room, like, holy shit. He's like, what's up, guys? And he was my hero growing up. I loved The Clash. They're one of my favorite bands of all time. But Joe Strummer in particular was like the guy I identified with, because you could tell that he had just kind of done this for the fuck of it, and it was working for him, and he was smart, and he has heart in a good place. Anyway, he was that guy.
Yeah. He's a dude. He was just like, you turn around, he's just like, just like I said, I was gobsmacked. He was sitting there, and then it's just like, wow, he's like the coolest guy on the planet too. Just like he told him to be, you know?
He called me up when he came to New York to do those Brooklyn shows, man. He's like, he goes, we hanging out? I was like, yeah, we hanging out. He's like, where are you? I was like, I'm at the studio doing some stuff with the Criminals. He's like, all right, I'm coming by. And you will hear a funny story about that day was, he came by that day, he saw you, and then we started, like, I think we were doing something in the mix room, and the live room was empty, because he went in there to try to, like, take a nap, man. He was like, I'm going to rest before my show. And like, yeah, we're cool with that. And he was going to like hang out in some baffle blankets or some shit. And we were like, no, dude, there's a fucking bedroom here, Joe. And he was like, really? I was like, yeah. He goes, this shit is cool. So we open up this bedroom, which is towards the window, the elevator's there.
Towards the back, yep.
Yeah, and he was like, yo, wake me at 6 p.m. We're like, whatever, cool, man, no problem. And then Anthony and his boys from the band came over. And then it was like 5:50, and they're like, yeah, we're going to get Joe. We're going to go to Brooklyn. I was like, you ain't waking him up, man. They're like, no, we have to wake him up. I was like, at 6 o'clock, I'm knocking on the door. Don't make me get violent. You know, I was like, being real protective of my guy, because I was my dude in my studio relaxing. But I remember at exactly 6 o'clock, I was like, and he's like, hello, Huey. I was like, all right, man, he's ready to go, man. Yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah, it's like, you know, like that saying, never meet your heroes. Mm. Sometimes that's true, but in that particular instance, it certainly was not true. Yeah.
I told him that thing one time. I said, you know, you hear that, never meet your heroes, bro, but I met you, man. He's like, fuck you, man. I was like, no, you know what I'm trying to say, Joe. He's like, fuck you, man. But he's like, because he used to tell people to fuck themselves in the most a beautiful way.
Exactly. Yeah, it was like that. I did, so I was working on a Lou Reed record, and David Bowie came in to sing on one of the songs for a couple of days. He's doing vocals for a couple of days.
Cool.
Yeah, and I'm sitting there, and it's just like, it dawns on me, like, these guys were equally responsible for each other's career.
Yeah, in a way, it was kind of...
Because Bowie produced Transformers.
Yeah. So
they kind of put each other sort of on the map together. And to see them in the room together, like, 35 years later, and they just, like, the... You couldn't get more opposite of human beings.
Yeah,
there's,
yeah,
like, curmudgeon-y Lou in the background, grumbling and done. And then walks David Bowie. I'm just like, man, I really hope that... Yeah, I just pray, man. I was like, please, just don't be a dick, right? And he comes in, he's like the most affable, just warm, just like this really cool guy.
Oh, man, he's great.
Thank God, man.
I met him, like, I don't know, maybe... I met him in 96 or, like, 97 at a festival. He was mad cool, right? And, like, every time he'd come to New York, if he felt like calling me up, he would. And I'd bend it all out for David Bowie. But we got to, like, where King worked and shit like that.
Yeah.
And go out to the nightclubs. Because he always wanted to go, like, where the young people were hanging out. And that's why he was so awesome. Because he was like the true citizen of the world kind of guy, because I knew a lot of people who knew him around the world. He did the same shit. He was just really awesome. And I met him again at the Tribeca Film Festival. I was dating that actress girl. And that girl knew his wifey mom, right?
Yep.
So they start to talk, right? And, of course, it's fucking David Bowie. And when they're talking, I'm like, oh, what's up, man? He's like, what's up, Huey? And, like, we go off and we start smoking, because that's what we do, man, you know? So we're doing what we're doing. And, you know, he says, you know, I'm Huey, you a Marine? I was like, yeah, dude. He goes, this is right when the Iraq War started. The second one. And 2003-ish, around there.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, what do you think about this whole thing going on in Iraq, man? I was like, man, as a Marine, I just always think it's a terrible thing that you got to send for the Marines, man, because that means someone's getting fucked up. And he was like, yeah. He goes, I think so, too. But he goes like this, but I'm a faggot married to a Muslim. And right. And like, I look at him and he's got that twinkle in his eye. Like, don't you think this is fucking funny? And I just started laughing. I was like, you are a crazy motherfucker, man. And he was just like, oh, Huey, I'm an old crazy motherfucker. I was like, dude, man, let's go out and get drunk. And, you know, yeah, we got hammered that night. He was a great dude like that, though, man.
Yeah, I mean, it was just like he went to the live room and did his thing, and like Lou was like grumbling in the background. So David comes in, he's kind of like, you know, like shy about, oh, how's it sound? I'm just like, well, you know, tell you the truth, this fucking sounds just like David Bowie. And he just started cracking up. Exactly what I meant. I'm like, dude, like, you're fucking David Bowie, bro. What the hell? Come on, you sound just like David Bowie. Get done.
It's odd, though, man, because a lot of those dudes are actually really humble. Like, Joe was very humble, and, you know, David was very humble. A lot of the dudes were just, like, because they kind of knew at the end of the day that it was, like, you know, what Keith calls lightning in a bottle, man. You know, if it happens, great, but you know exactly what it is. It's not because...
Yeah, and you know it could be gone tomorrow.
Yeah, and that's those old-timers knew that shit, man.
Yep. And they lived, you know, they had to live like that, too, because you just know, I mean... We all know people who, you know, who had started out with great careers and sort of just, like, faded off into the ether, you know?
Yeah, it's just, a lot of people can't handle, I don't want to say the stress, because I don't know if it's the stress. It's the,
it is.
Well, maybe, I think it's, like, the reality of it. Because, you know, when I first came up, you know, they pumped you full of all that hot air, man. And I wasn't going for it, because I was a Marine, man. I was like, yeah, I know. Don't fuck with me. I ain't stupid. And I think a lot of people... We're all too happy just to think that that was how reality was, man. And I don't know. I just think it was like you just had to keep yourself grounded. I was 27 before when we got my record contract, so I was grown, really. You know, you were the same age as me, pretty much, right? So
yeah, I'm like a year or two older, like a year and a half older than you.
Yeah, I'm 48 now, so
I'm 50.
All right, so yeah, so I'll be 49 in August, but it's just one of those things. I just kind of thought that we had that same kind of, you know, you always got to keep that kind of same mentality, man. And like the thing that I learned from Joe and David and all those real big timers, even like Bono and those guys, you can say what you want about that dude, but yo, he never, you know, I don't even want to say it on the podcast, but he never sucked nobody's dick, man. All right. You know, but that's Bono, man. That's what he fucking believes. And I know there's a crazy shit in the world. You could be on the phone with him talking about something and then he'll bring up fucking world peace, man. Cause that's who the fuck he is, man.
Yeah.
And if, like, you know,
there was a period there, and I, you know, it was probably me and not him, where I just wanted to hate that fucking band. So I really wanted to hate them. I just wanted to. I don't know why you want to fucking hate you too. And when they dropped Octoon Baby, I was just like fucking so hammered. I was like, I could not believe how great that fucking record was.
It's sick, man. I mean, those guys recorded such amazing music, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it was
actually, I think it was through you, because your boy Tony was actually doing their security.
I think he's still working with them.
Yeah, so it's like you guys hooked me up with him, who hooked up me and Ruth with the whole VIP thing, the whole thing at Madison Square Garden. I was just like, oh, man. And it's like, I really just want to see the show. It's cool. It's like, man, I love you guys. It's like, oh, Huey. Oh, my God, you work with Huey. We love that shit. It's like, I just want to go see the show. And it was one of the rare times as an adult that I just sat there, just absolutely plastered to the floor. I couldn't move. They were that good.
Those guys do not fuck around. I mean, we toured with them 20 years ago, man. We went on, like, we did, like, I think 30 American dates and through Canada with them. And they were playing, we were playing freaking football stadiums, like 100,000 people, man. And they owned that shit. They owned it from the front to the back and all the way in between, man. There was not a night that they didn't kill a whole fucking place, man. I mean, I was never...
And that only comes with time, because I remember, dude, it was probably 1984, I saw them right after Boy came out.
Yeah, that was
at Stony Brook University out on Long Island.
What was the gig out there? What was it? Stone Pony? No, that's Jersey. That's Jersey.
Stony Brook University. It was like this college, this big college.
I know where it is, yeah.
Yeah, on Long Island. And I had never seen anything like it in my life. I was like, holy fuck, it was one of the best shows there. I still remember the show. So, like I said, I went through the period where I wanted to hate them, and then all of a sudden I was like, God, I can't deny, I just cannot deny.
You can't deny them, man. You know, there's a reason, like, they just had the perfect storm. I mean, it was, and you know, the thing is, these guys are still together breaking each other's balls. You know, like when Bono goes and does something silly, you know, edges on his ass and Larry's on everybody else's ass. It's, you know, they're still a good squad, man. You know who they looked out after was Bulldog. Because he was in that fucking Bataclan shit with Eagles of Death Metal, man. He was the tour manager, bro. And I just had dinner with him last week, man. And he's good, man. But he was like, it was kind of weird because U2 called them up and was like, you know, we have a jet in country if you need to get out and stuff like that. Which is, you know, that's why those guys in U2 are pretty fucking awesome, because they don't just sit around like Dr. Evil, man.
Man, they absolutely get it. They're just good people, though, is what it comes down to. And also, in my estimation, I think they are the last and final in history, the last supergroup.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I was talking about some of the other, because I was talking to Bulldog. And anyway, he was saying that he asked for Tony when Bono called up. And he's like, Tony? You mean Tony? Like, yeah, Tony. And, you know, for those who don't know Tony, he's a super commando. Anyway, so...
Yeah, he is that guy.
Yeah,
it's a little bit more than security.
Yeah,
it's
that guy.
He's so many different levels.
Yeah, anyway, but they were like, yeah, because Bulldog wanted to talk to someone who had been in that kind of situation before. And, you know, they were just really super cool, man. And they brought them, I think they flew them back at some point too. I don't think Bulldog went all the way back again. I don't know if he was down with that, but yeah, he's doing good, man. And it's kind of odd, because if you're in this business long enough, you realize they're only like maybe 50 or 60 people you keep seeing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's not like they're like thousands of people kind of like washing through the rock and roll business. If you're a certain age, it's just a bunch of us, man. We know each other.
Everybody knows each other.
Yeah.
But I think they're the last super group who would be, you know, like the stadium.
Well, you know, like, I think you're right, because, you know, I remember seeing them, and I was not necessarily a big U2 fan. I knew the singles, right, and all that shit, yep. MTV and stuff. So I knew was pretty versed with their stuff. But when we opened up for them, the first night we were in Arrowhead Stadium in Kansas City.
Uh-huh.
Wow. Big gig, man, yeah, right? And I watched their show after we played, right? And then, first of all, the crowd was really nice because they know that U2 picks their own opening bands.
Yep.
So that's like a history there. So the people that were there early came to hear what U2 was listening to, which is great for us, you know? So people were really cool, and I sat and watched their show, and I knew every fucking song they played. And
yep.
They, like, every song. Yep. And dude was like, his vocals were super on delivery. The band was super tight together. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, every night I was just like, wow, that's how a band's supposed to be. And that's what, when you see, like, you know, I saw the Stones with Dave Grohl in Jersey for Siani's Stag Night.
Yep.
That shit was crazy. And they were killing it. But they're the Stones, man. They've been killing it for 50 fucking years, man.
Exactly.
But, yeah, you two are the only guys that could do that. I don't think, like, Coldplay or any of those bands have really got that many songs.
It's not even the songs. Are they going to be around 20 years from now selling out stadiums?
I don't know, man. I don't know who's going to be doing that shit, man.
And that's what I mean. It says, like, even, like, you know, with the passing, we you know, the music family lost so many last year.
That was crazy.
And I was saying, like, people just don't – I don't know if they necessarily agree with me or disagree with me, but I was like – I don't really mean it disrespectfully to anybody current, but I just don't see anybody who kind of like took the torch, you know, like who kind of like was trying to like best Prince.
Yeah, just doing shit like that. It's
yeah, because like Prince was always trying to. He wasn't just trying to be Prince. He was trying to be better than everybody else before.
Yeah. He was like, he was trying to fuck with
the best.
He was trying to fuck with Mozart, man. Man.
Well, yeah.
You know, Prince was, but Prince was,
I don't see anybody really taking the torch like the David Bowie torch, you know?
Yeah. I just think it's going to happen, but it might be from a different point of view, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, you got to look at those guys in particular, right? I mean, who, that's the thing. It's like, you know, who would actually be the person that would try to be the best at everything, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
I don't completely, like, not disrespectfully or anything, but it's just, like, I just don't see anybody kind of, like, filling that void, you know?
Yeah, it seems like, yeah, because also it's, you know, where are you going to go with music now? Because Prince did take rock and soul and R&B and funk and squash it together into Prince music, right?
Yep. Yeah.
David Bowie took soul and blue-eyed soul and funk and rock and indie, whatever. He started indie, probably, right? Glam, yeah. You know, whatever you want, and squashed it into David Bowie music. And all the people that we talk about that we love that just were the most amazing talents, they weren't doing a certain type of music. They're doing their music.
Their music, yeah.
Right? It didn't sound like anybody else's. You know, like, for good, bad, or indifferent, if you put one of our records on, Tim, you know it didn't sound like anybody else.
It sounds like
Fun Loving Criminals, and I think that's great, and that's why I made that kind of music, because I thought it was important, you know, just to be different. And I think in the age of everybody being the same now, kind of. I mean, when you hear like stuff on broadcast radio, it's like, oh gosh, man. Like,
and that's also like the technology side of it, like my end of it. It all kind of ties together because it all sounds the same.
Now, do you find, I mean, when you do like if you're doing like a new joint or whatever, do you listen to other stuff to see what to avoid maybe?
Oh, absolutely. Like my morning routine is like, I'm up early, man. I'm old now. I go to bed early. I'm up early. So So my morning routine is like, I make my coffee and I sit down and I power up and I put on Skype and I go through like the Hot 100, whatever the fuck. Right. So I want to hear what's going on. And I'm listening. I'm almost like, man, this is just something. Ass. It's poorly written, poorly produced, and it sounds like shit too, and poorly engineered it is. And it's treated exactly how it was approached. And I look at it as disposable.
Yeah. Know? Well, we were talking about the theory of the McDonald's, right? You know, everything's just really instant gratification.
Yeah. I mean, you got a Big Mac in Moscow or a Big Mac in Montana. It's the same fucking thing.
Yeah, word.
You know? So everything kind of got like Happy Meals. You know, it's, but I think particularly with R&B, that's what I just find disappointing, you know? It's been the same drum sounds for fucking 25, 30 years at this point.
Well, isn't it like Pete Rock is responsible for everything on the radio? Because his snare sound is like, literally, if you take that Pete Rock snare sound, that's like on 80% of the music out there.
80% of
the
record, yeah.
It's crazy, yeah. Man. You just get another snare sound, man.
Just get a different sound. Write a song with a bridge.
All right, so, yo, you got to clear something up for me, man. What the fuck is up with mumble rap?
You're talking
to an
old man.
You're
talking
to a
50-year-old man.
No, but, Lil Yachty and Lil Uzi Vert and these kids, man. I hear it, and I'm just like, all right, I was around when, like, Planet Rock came out and all that real shit. And it just, you could at least understand what the fuck they were saying. you have to be from their fucking building to understand what the fuck they're saying.
They're not even neighborhood, but from their building.
Yeah, from their building, man. It's like, yeah. Yo, man, what is going on?
I don't know.
And yo, do you like Drake?
I know I'm supposed to.
Yeah, me too, man. Because he's Canadian. That's why, man. Because he's really not a Drake. Like, I mean, he's probably a nice guy.
Before we even talked about this, like, I know I'm supposed to like him, but I just can't find anything to hook onto.
Yeah, you know, it's
not like I don't find him bad or offensive or anything like that, but I can't.
Yeah, I feel you too. Know? He seems like he's a nice guy. I think I met him one time, and he was nice. I think I met him. Someone said I met him, and he was nice. I was like, then he's nice. But he's Canadian. They're all nice, really, up there, man. They're nice Canadian people. But
yeah.
Like you said, there's nothing really that's – I mean, he's like a theater kid or something, isn't he? A theater school kid or something? Because he seems like he's just way too polished being unpolished. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. There's like no there, or is he? Just to quote, you know, Bill, my hero Bill Clinton there. Yeah. My hero bullshit.
Dang.
You know, and it's kind of like the same with like a lot of R&B. I mean, there are some that I just, you know, it's the same thing with The Weeknd. It's like, I know I'm supposed to love him.
Yeah,
I do like some of it.
Oh,
it's like,
man.
I'm just like,
it seems, yeah, it just seems like like those two guys in particular, because they're like really, you could tell they're talented dudes, but they seem like they're like, there's just something going on where it's not, I don't think it's like, so it doesn't hit the authentic button on me.
Definitely not, man. But like Kendrick Lamar?
Yeah,
that's just real.
Kenny got crazy shit, man. You know that guy Supercat?
Yep.
That fucking record had me bugging. He was like, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Kenny Loggins. I was like, holy shit, this is amazing. He's like, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Michael McDonald. I was like, no.
Yeah.
Those are like two of my favorite fucking guys on one record.
Yep.
So you knew he's a bass player, right? But he
did not know that.
Yeah, he's a bass player. He plays this big old kind of like, it looks like a, it's weird, it looks like an acoustic, like, you know, mariachi bass, but it's electric. Uh-huh. It's like, it looks like it's kind of semi-hollow or whatever.
Yeah, it's the Ampeg baby bass.
Oh, yeah, it's cool, man. But it's big, like a motherfucker.
Yeah.
But I think he played drums in the Suicidal Tendencies.
What?
That's crazy, right? He's cooked.
He's not crazy.
You got it. It's too slight. He's hooked up with them somehow. Because remember, I don't know, we toured with Porno for Pyros back in the day, right? And that was Jane's Addictions, the dude Perry Farrell's band, right? Yep. And all those dudes from L.A., all his crew, they were all Crips from Venice. But they were white dudes that were Crips from Venice. It was a very weird dynamic, but I rolled with it. And they had this dude that rolled with them called Josh the Bagel, and he was a Crip. And his best friend was this guy Mike, who was the singer Mike Muir from the Tendencies, right? And Schnapp knew him too. So there was like this big fucking West Coast yeehaw we had with all these Crips. We used to go out there and fucking hang out on Electric Avenue and walk up and down the fucking boardwalk blazing and shit with all these crazy gunned up dudes, man. That whole shit was all Cripped out, man. And this dude.
And now it makes sense though, because now I'm looking at, I got the video, I can see the video of mine for institutionalized. He's got the, you know, he's wearing his collar.
The blue bandana, man, yeah.
He's got a blue bandana on.
And like, you know, I was from New York, so I'm like the blood crib. I don't know, man. I'm here for the ladies and the marijuana, you know? And I'm not here for the violence. But, yo, that's how this guy Thundercat, if he was down with them, I mean, he's a pretty awesome dude in that respect, if he played drums in the Suicidal Tendencies. But that record sounds really cool. I like him too, man.
Yeah, I mean, it's some really cool stuff out there, but like the stuff that I know I'm supposed to like, I'm just like, I just, you know.
Yo, the record of my record of last year was maybe that new Tribe record, I think.
That was, I mean, I am so, I don't know what the word is, but I'm just like, again, as a fan, a huge fan of them. I had the pleasure and the fortune to work with them. But I was, like, looking forward. I was, like, kind of looking forward to it, but I was, like, a little nervous. I'm like, oh, man, what this? Yeah. It's been a long time. I didn't know what to expect. And I was blown away by what Q-Tip and Ali had done.
Yeah, Tip, they recorded at his, like, home studio, right?
Because he built, like, a whole thing, like, down in the spot.
Yeah, man, see, because he moved, because remember he lost his record collection when he had that fire that time?
Big fire, yeah.
But anyway, so this new record, I'm listening to it, right? And it's from an absolute big fan, huge fan of Tribe Called Quest, right? I was like, wow, this was, like, one of those records where you could tell, like, you know, they had a couple takes of Malik doing some shit, and, it, like, that was all they had, man. But yeah. they made it work. Because I think nowadays it's also, if you have a good background for production, like, you know, those guys work with you, so they know there's the quality control there.
Exactly.
You know, you can make something that's not necessarily, like, high definition, high fidelity work in a high fidelity, high definition arena if you make it sound a certain way. That record was just killing it, man.
They killed it.
And Jonathan kills the bass, man, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. He played bass.
I think Ali.
Oh, Ali played the bass
too. Ali did a lot of stuff with Rafael Sadiq.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, man, you did that big record with him. They also had that dude who was Anderson .Paak. He played drums on some shit.
Yep.
He rhymed on that record. He's really good. He's good on the Dr. Dre Compton record.
Yep.
Yeah, I like that dude's voice. But he was like a session drummer for a minute.
Yeah, like I said, it's like that record. I was like. Really, I was just like so excited for him. Like, oh, thank God, man.
Yeah, that's been my gym record since the first of the year. I've been hitting the gym and hitting that record. And it's always when I get to.
I was like hitting gym. I'm like, what happened? What did Jim do to you? What, did he steal your money or something?
Yeah,
like
Jim, you money? Jim be talking to my girl without my permission, man. He's getting handled. He's getting handled, man. But yeah, that's my record. I do this like 20-minute high intensity elliptical thing, and I know it's almost over when that kids song comes on with Andre 3000. Kids, don't you know how this shit is fantasy? Kids, don't you know how this shit is fantasy? But that record is so insightful, and those guys have always been the type of band that they did it right, don't you think? They ended their career with an amazing record. It was number one in America, you know.
Yeah.
Critically acclaimed. They went on the Grammys and made it interesting.
Yeah. It was awesome. Yeah, it was just Huey Morgan.
Well, my man Tim Latham, ISP. And that's the thing people don't understand when they see your name and it says ISP. Like the but people think
that
it's
was like before, like email. So they didn't know what the hell he's talking about. My own service provider? What the hell he's talking about?
Oh, it's International Sound Pimp. And that's been, you know, who gave you that, man? I think maybe I gave you that one, didn't I?
it was this band out of Atlanta, actually. It was a really, really cool band. And it was like one of those things where, like, they were just too good. Like, it was just like went over so many people's heads that, like, nobody can understand what to do with them. I remember specifically that they would call themselves the Modern Hip Hop Quartet. So the Modern Jazz Quartet, but there's three of them. And they just wrote, like, these amazing songs. And, like, one of the lead guy was just like, he's like, man, Latham, you're like a pimp when it comes to this sound. Like, you're like a sound pimp, but you work all over the world. You're like an international sound pimp. And that was 1993, and that shit, 92, and that shit just stuck.
Yeah, man. But you also 3M so Visionary Award winner, multiples, you know?
Yeah, multiple Visionary Award winner.
Does that mean they give you some 2-inch tape to kind of keep in your basement or anything?
Yeah, exactly. Like, literally, so the people listening know there was a manufacturer that manufactured basically like floppy disks and like tape.
What? Tape? Floppy disks? What is this you speak of?
Yeah, so they were manufacturing like tape and like floppy disks and stuff. And I remember when Platinum Island, they gave me like this piece of marble, like this beautiful, you know, this beautiful thing.
It was
like
a nice plaque.
Yeah, it's this nice flag, and it's funny too because it's in my in-laws' house, and my brother-in-law is a retired Secret Service agent. So you've got like pictures of like him and like George Bush and Barbara Bush and him and like Bill Clinton. And there's like this 3M Visionary Award for Mobb Deep.
Yes, yo, Mobb Deep, protecting the president. They're two very important things, man. We need them both, man. Yo, Tim, I'm gonna let you get busy, man. Dude, it was good talking to you, man. We should do this again, bro.
Absolutely. I'm pretty sure we will be soon because of another mimosa. I think I need another one, bro.
Yeah, man. Well, I'll send you what we've been working on. Dude. Tim Latham, International Sound Pimp. I love you, bro. It's good talking to you, man. We got to catch up and have some dinner.
You, Morgan, one of my favorite people on the planet. I love you, bro. I miss you, and I can't wait to see you again.
Likewise. Love to the family, brother.
Back to you as Becky and the kid, bro.
I will. I love you, man. I'll talk to you soon, brother, man. Thank you for this, bro.
Yeah. Peace, bro.
Right on, man.
Well, how'd you like that? Did you keep up? Good. I had a great time talking with my old buddy Tim. He's an awesome guy to catch up with, and especially across the pond, I love technology. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Continuing the musical theme to my pod next week, I'm talking to the modern-day pod father, rapper, actor, label boss, and true gentleman, Scroobius Pip. So tune in. You don't want to miss this one. In fact, better than that, subscribe, my peoples. It really helps the pod if you rate, review, and subscribe. And don't forget to sign up at HueyMorgan.com during May, or during any time. But in May, you get a very special chance of winning a dope exclusive merch bundle. Until next time, y'all, stay classy.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.